So I can't express my gratitude enough to Jay and to Sam for creating this program and to maintaining the program, because I hate to put it this way, but when I was your age, which was quite a while ago, actually, my ambition when I was in high school was to emulate my high school biology teacher by becoming one. And I didn't do that. I mean, for some reason, I just never went back to teaching in high school. I taught here for 38 years instead. But I had the privilege of inviting him to my lab once with his class from high school during the school year. And his first comment to me was, "Are you still getting your reports in late?" So I said, "Yeah, we have a little help now. I have an administrator that helps me with due dates for grants and stuff like this." But the answer was yes, I still was getting my reports in late. My papers were late. My grant reviews were late. Everything was late. Why? Because we all suffer from attention deficit. Or we are interested in everything we see. So we just get distracted. I mean, how do you stay focused, right? I mean, I know you have to, but the question is, how do you do that? And so, if you look at my first presentation here, it was all about parasites, because that's what I'm trained as, a parasitologist. And I talked about where do they come from, why are they still here, and why will they always be here. And in fact, they're probably better for you than you think they are. I mean, not all parasites are lethal. And in fact, all of your endosymbionts, which you would now call your microbiome, which I've presume you've heard that term now? How many have heard the term microbiome? How many have not heard the term microbiome? Good, the ones that have heard about it, you tell the others what that is. That's the secret to good teaching. Never admit that you know the answer, but elicit it from the crowd, right? So your microbiome is basically all of the microbes that cover your body or live inside of you. And you can imagine what that must have been like adjusting to that. Well, it's easy to find it out. Just go over to the nursery over here, to the delivery room, and then go to the nursery. And you can see all those screaming little kids. You know why they're screaming? Because they're born sterile. Right, we're all born sterile. And then we acquire the microbiome. That's painful. Lots of gas, lots of schmutz, lots of tissues that get invaded and colonized, and you have to adjust to that. And all of those bacterial species, and even the viruses, I'm not sure they qualify as symbionts. Their job is to take advantage of you. But I think all of the bacterial symbionts that actually help us, including digest our food and make vitamins for us and keep the bad guys out, at one time they were bad guys. So we are sort of like the halfway house for bad microbes, and we turn them and convert them. Or even more radical thinking, maybe they turn us. Maybe they control our immune system. Maybe we act at their behest. They are remarkably resilient organisms. Okay, so I began talking about this, right? I've already diverted from the subject, but not quite. Because I can come back to this anytime. And I have an hour, so I can... or more. I know the pizza's coming, so I won't delay that. But so that was my first talk. And then I talked about other things related to parasites and how they help us and how, if we knew more about them, they could be even more helpful. And if you look at the NIH granting situation today, and I'm sure Sam would acknowledge this too, it's horrible. It's not just bad, it's horrible. You have to have already done the work almost in order to get a grant, to pay for the work that you've already done. That's retro, you know, that's really retro. If you go to other countries, it's not like that. But in many cases it is. So the point is that where do you get all this data that you need in order to learn more about these sort of renegades of the developed world, but real serious problems of the undeveloped world? How do we take advantage of their secrets? So I just, I know this is horn tooting 101, all right? You got to toot your own horn sometime, right? And you don't get many opportunities. So I've just published a book, which is in publication production right now, called Parasites, People, and Plowshares. And if you invite me back next year, if I hope there is next year, I will talk about how do we learn about parasites enough to discover their secrets of longevity inside of a really well-equipped immune system. How can we take advantage of their biological secrets to better our medicine chest? How can we derive some of their substances to help us with problems that don't relate at all to the parasites themselves? So even if they were to go away, we would still need to be working on them in order to unlock their secrets. That's the point. And you can't convince people of this other than you, because you're already converted. So talking here, say we need more money for things that don't appear to be medically relevant, but which could be extremely relevant if we were to find a new anticoagulant, for instance, or a new way to elicit blood vessels, for instance, or a new way to head off the immune system to prevent rejection of heterologous transplants. There are parasites that actually do that already. Really, you say. No, really, I say, honest. And if we could learn those secrets, we could be far ahead of the curve in terms of our own evolution. So if you pick up this month's Scientific American, you can see, you've got it already, it says beyond science. Is there anything beyond science? I guess metaphysics, but you know, that's not in our realm. What could be beyond science? Science is just asking questions and then trying to get the truth of the answers to them. So I'm going to tell you about a project that arose in my classroom when my grant stopped. I had a grant for 27 years. I'm proud of that. I did a lot of work. I published a lot of papers that some people have even read. You know, because you get relegated to the bookshelves eventually. But I had a wonderful time asking questions to which there were no answers, basically. But along the way to not answering that question, you answered 10 more questions that arose as the result of your own native ability to tap into your excitement level and to produce a set of work which forced you to run to work every day, right? So you run to work. You don't just walk to work. And you're thinking about the next experiment all the time. So I can't say I lost my grant because I know exactly where it went. It went somewhere else. So this is life after grants, basically. So what do you do after that? So remember, I wanted to be a teacher all my life. I've always wanted to teach, and I've taught. And I've been rewarded for it, too. I must say I'm grateful for the awards that I've received, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. I would just do the whole thing over again because I had so much fun doing it. And I'm having fun right now. So I began teaching more. So I offered 2 more courses that I had never taught before, but which fit into my science background. One was called Ecology, and I called it Ecology 101 to make it palatable to people that had never even had science before. The School of Public Health attracts a lot of those people. That's where I taught. So if you're a person interested in, let's say, public health policy, right, and you come into the School of Public Health and you say, what do I have to take all this science for? I want to be a policymaker. How could you make policy? Based on what? Yeah, based on what exactly? How can you make decisions unless you know a little bit about the scientific method? Public health is about the world and how people live in it and how we head off problems associated with population density and pollution and food sources and all kinds of stuff. How do we do that? So Ecology 101 was the first course I offered. The second one was called Medical Ecology. And that's to sort of pull people in that wanted to go to medical school, didn't quite make it, got into the School of Public Health, were taking MPH degrees, and here's a course called Medical. I don't care, medical anything. Medical informatics, medical science, medical economics, medical, I'll just take it. It'll look good on my CV. Oh yeah, you think, huh? We'll see about that. So, but in order to take that course, you had to take the Ecology 101 first. So medical ecology said, basically, if you damage the environment, No matter how small the damage, ultimately there's some health risk associated with it. Everybody seems to nod and say, yeah, that makes sense. But just how does that work? Well, in order to know how it works, you have to know how, if you're a watchmaker and you fix watches, you have to know how the whole watch works, right? So then you can take it all apart and find out which part's missing or broken and replace it. And so ecological process is a little bit more complicated, of course, but you can make an analogy there. And by fixing the watch, you can find out, oh, it's broken over here. How can you make policy about public health issues without knowing what's broken? So I got about halfway through this course of medical ecology, of here's what's broken, here's what's broken. Oh, yeah, and over here, here's what's broken. About halfway through that, the 7 students in the class came to me and said, you know, we really appreciate the fact that you're going to great lengths to give us this information, but now we can't sleep, we can't eat, we're afraid to drink anything, unless it's triple distilled water. We don't see any purpose to continuing our education because the earth is completely falling apart. Now, that wasn't the picture I was painting, but that's the picture they derived from not hearing about, well, positive change. So I said, this was the first year I offered this course, right? So here's the difference between what you guys do and what I did. I can suspend the semester. I can, okay, from now on, you tell me what you want to work on and I'll let you do that. They're paying a lot of money for this, right? And it's their time. So why shouldn't they be allowed to work on something they found useful? So they came back to me the week after that and said, we'd like to work on a project localized to New York City that relates to growing food on rooftops. Let's see if we can feed New York City by growing food on rooftops. That sounds like a good idea, actually. Let's see if that's even possible. So for the next half semester, they worked on it. And they concluded at the end, of course, you might be able to guess at the answer to that question, that they couldn't even feed Manhattan based on the amount of rooftop available in Manhattan. They wanted to raise rice, which has the most energy per bite of any plant that you can grow. And they could feed about 2% of Manhattan based on the amount of land available that they could make from the rooftops. So give me their look. Come on, you can give me their look. They've worked very hard for this. They almost to the last day, they were still positive. And here's something that was even worse than they were hearing about before. So they're sitting there practically crying. What are you going to say to these people? I mean, you've got to give them some hope here, right? So here's what I said. I said, you guys worked really hard. You used the scientific method. You went to the map room at the 42nd Street Library. The maps are this big as this table, this entire table. Right. Two people with gloved hands turned the pages. And they sat there with their rulers and protractors and measured exactly the footprint of every building that had a roof that was not a commercial building, just apartment houses. And that's how they got their number. And I said, you worked your fingers to the bones and you got the right answer. The right answer was you can't feed New York City based on the available land on the rooftops. And then, you know, they started to smile a little bit. And then I said, but what if we took your idea of the rooftop garden and moved it inside and filled up the whole building? Imagine how many abandoned apartment houses there are in New York. 1999, there were quite a few. There probably are still quite a few. Not just apartment buildings. South Bronx was one of those places, and probably still is. Now, there's a lot of land that's unused and a lot of land that's misused, and some land that's not even considered land, like Floyd Bennett Air Force Base. So you could construct buildings in which you could grow food inside, if you could do that, of course, and who knows if you could do that. But let's think about that. And this was the last day of class. Last day of class, the class dismissed, nice job. So that summer, my wife and I are driving. This is not anecdotal, I'll get to this. Trust me, I'll get to this. Because what you're seeing here is the realization of that dream. What you're seeing here is the realization of 10 years of hard work in a class that every year got bigger, The ideas got more refined. People began to hear about it. We put it on the internet. We expected them to chop it down. Instead, they built it up, for the most part. Even The Guardian, which is a very radical English newspaper, published an article on the idea of vertical farming first, liked it very much. Then the next article that came out trashed it completely. That's the Brits for you, what can I say? Without ever having an example of one to throw darts at. So how would you like someone to say, you know, I don't like the fact that you're thinking about making an airplane. I really don't think it's going to fly. Really, come back in another year. I want to take you on a trip above the ground in my airplane. So, you know, that's the kind of the criticism that spawns people of my temperament to try even harder to prove them wrong. Using science. You have to use science. You can't do it any other way. You know, you can say all you want, but show me the proof. Give me the idea in writing, and then I want to work on it. I want to build models. I want to build prototypes, and then we'll see. Okay, but before that, the only thing you can criticize is whether it's a good idea or not a good idea to move all of the agricultural initiatives in the world from the outdoors to the indoors. Is that a crazy idea, or is that a good idea? That's what I want to talk about. So, you're in a disadvantaged location. Why don't you move this chair over there? Excellent. All right. So, better? Better. All right. So why, the term vertical farms means, to me at least, more than two stories worth of indoor farming within an urban center. Now, you're all familiar, I'm sure, with urban agricultural initiatives, especially if you teach in New York City, and you do. You might know that there's a school called the Manhattan School for Children. It's on 93rd Street, Amsterdam Avenue. I've been there multiple times because they have a really swell, terrific greenhouse on the rooftop that uses hydroponics and aquaponics as a science teaching tool. And I hope every school gets one of those eventually. I do. So we have to ask first, why do we need this? All right, this might be too small for some of you to read, but I'll just read it anyway. We want to ward off plant diseases like wheat rust and rice blast. Those are big killers for plants outside. We want to get rid of insect pests. How do you do that? You just make a window. You know, they can bash their little heads up against that all day long, and they'll never get in if we design the doors right. Right? So we don't want a P4 facility. You have to get dressed up in a spacesuit for that one. P2 is enough. You know what that means? It's a barrier, okay? We want to create a barrier. Some of you did work at that level this summer. It's easy. You just have a positive pressured room. You have a double door lock. You have to change your clothes. And you should probably take a shower before you come to work. Severe weather, that doesn't really occur indoors, right? We don't find a lot of indoor farmers like greenhouse owners praying for rain, or praying for sunshine, or praying for not so much rain. And we now, most of us live in cities. This says 50%, but it's really about 55%. And in another 20 years, it'll be 70%. And it might even get to be as high as 80%. So that's where we live. So why shouldn't that be where our food comes from? You say, but because it's a city, for gosh sakes, how could you make food from a city? Show you. Oil prices are linked to food prices. Are you kidding me? Yeah, that's true. The United States spends 20% of its fossil fuel energy farming. 20%. To give you a comparison, we spend another 20% in automotive propulsion. So gasoline and diesel fuel for cars accounts for 20% of the fossil fuels used in this country. Another 20% is going just to farming. That's a lot. That's a lot. The rest is all industrial. Phosphate. Phosphate. What the hell is phosphate? Well, it's an element, of course. It's on the periodic table. Everyone can see it. It's got a P. It's right there. It's one of the essential nutrients. And you can't make DNA without it. So we mine it, right? There are huge deposits of phosphates in about three different places. One of them is in the Middle East, in Jordan. I didn't visit the mine. I was about 100 miles away from it. It's where about a third of the phosphate deposit comes from that goes into artificial fertilizers. And on the outside of the fertilizer bag, it's NPK. N, nitrogen, P, phosphorus, K, potassium. We have about 100 years left if we continue to use it at the rate we're doing now. And China has increased its rate of phosphate use in fertilizers. It doubles every year. And we know how much phosphates are left. There's another deposit in Utah. And I think there's another deposit somewhere in Africa. I'm not sure. Sam, do you know? Chile. Exactly. Exactly. Chile. So you've got those three places. And they're digging like crazy. And they're shipping like crazy to these artificial fertilizer manufacturing centers. And by the way, it takes a lot of oil to make fertilizer, too, because they fix the nitrogen and make artificial nitrogen, right? Like ammonia. There's a process, a chemical process that some German discovered that you could use to make explosives or fertilizer, or you could have both. You know, it's candy. No, it's a breath mint. No, it's both. And then we have soil erosion that's occurring for two different reasons. One are floods and two are droughts. Either way, you lose your soil. So if you come back the next year and you try to plant, you're inhibited from planting as much as you did the year before. And that happens almost every year in some places. And so for these reasons, these are good reasons for trying to think about agriculture in another way. But the biggest reason I didn't even put up is the fact that agriculture pollutes worldwide more than any other human activity. It's the biggest source of non-point source pollution in the world. If you look at the estuaries for every major river leading from every major continent, you will find huge plumes of agricultural runoff, which you can imagine living in New Orleans, that's my hometown, out comes the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, draining the entire Midwestern agricultural initiative, and all of that runoff that the plants didn't take up, it ends up in the Gulf of Mexico. And you can, from outer space, watch the algal blooms occur as the result of nutrient enrichment. That is occurring around the world. Rates of cholera transmission are going up because of that. But rates of fish catch are going down. Today, the world eats 60% of its fish from farm-raised fish. 60%. That's enormous. Can you imagine the runoff from that? So shrimp farming, for instance, in Thailand, you go to your local A&P or even Whole Foods, and they show you where the stuff comes from, and you say, really? Vietnam? I'm buying shrimp from Vietnam? Because I love shrimp. It comes from all over the world, but it doesn't come from here. Why? Because our estuaries are all screwed up. We import 80% of the fish we eat. We export 80% of the crops we grow. Growing 80% of our crops creates the runoff that prevents us from eating. Well, you got the idea. Which foot would you like me to shoot yourself into? You have your choice. Fish, you know, plastic or paper. It doesn't matter. It's still going to damage the environment. So, okay. Today as we speak, that's yesterday's drought watch. I don't know if you're familiar with USGS drought watch, but it's really scary. Scary. Because if it's not this, it's floods. It's one or the other. It's not just perfect, all right? We have no Goldilocks climate anymore. It's out of control. And we are partially responsible. Not wholly, but partially responsible for it. And look at this. My son lives in Wichita, Kansas. Why? Because he likes it. Why? Because he's an air traffic controller. So I had the pleasure of visiting him on my way back from my extended vacation with my wife. We drove our brand new Prius station wagon. You know, if you talk the talk, you got to walk the walk. So we drove Route 80 all the way to southern Wyoming, fished our way up through the Tetons, the Yellowstone Park, and Glacier. And then she said, I've had enough. That was about a month. I let her off at Great Falls and then spent another 10 days out there. And then, yeah, I know. And then drove all the way back and met up with my son in Wichita, which is here, and then drove back to New Jersey via Route 70, not Route 80. So Route 70 takes you through the heartland, takes you right through the middle of this. And all I could see was golden fields of dried out corn. Corn, dried out corn, and withered soybeans. It looked like wheat until you looked closer. It wasn't wheat. And it's all abandoned. And it's all rotting in the soil, basically. The next time it rains, of course, you're going to lose all of that. So the farmers are plowing all that under and taking a loss. They're realizing their crop insurance payment, if they're lucky, and they're going to start again next year. How would you like to be a farmer? No way. I mean, even if it was okay physically, the mental anguish of a year like this, well, have they ever had another year like this? Sure. Just go back 3 years. Have they ever had another year like that? Go back another year before that. Last year, Texas lost $5 billion worth of crop. 5 years before that, they lost $4 billion worth of crop, but in real dollars, that's another $5 billion. $10 billion just for Texas, mostly cattle. All right, so you vegans out there are just rest easy. But even vegetables of various kinds, you've been to the stores. Don't go to Whole Foods because they can buy on consignment from really high-end places. Go to the A&P and see what the spinach looks like, if you can find it. Look for asparagus. It's not there. Look for all these truck crops that come from places like Arizona and the Imperial Valley of California, and you'll see what's happening out there. The food shortages are real. And if it's real here, you can imagine what it's like in countries where you're spending 50% of your annual income just on food, and the price doubles? Wait a minute. That means you're now spending 100% of your income on food. You can't do it. So people are starving. That's all I saw. I mean, I didn't see the machinery, but I saw this. It was horrible. If you can find corn at all, and you can, try it. You'll say, you know, something's wrong with this corn. It doesn't taste as good. It's not as sweet. It's not as this. It's not as... It's a horrible year. So, coming back to the concept of, well, is there another way to do all of this, or are we just going to throw up our hands and say, that's life? And our students said, we are not going to sit here and do nothing. We are going to imagine what it would be like if. So that's the biggest thing. Just suspend reality, put the science later, and let's just talk about the idea. Is this a good idea or is it a bad idea? Now, if you live in a city, great idea. Heck, everybody lives vertically anyway, so why not our crops? Can we grow stuff indoors? Of course we can. Have we been doing this for a long time? Of course we have. For how long? Well, commercially, since the 1930s. So hydroponic farming was invented at UC Davis in California, and people sort of ignored it. That was back in 1937. Why do you think 1937 is such an important year for indoor farming initiatives? How many people here have ever read, don't say movie, read Grapes of Wrath? Yes. Grapes of Wrath, one of the most depressing novels you can read. And okay, so part of this class, medical ecology, okay, kids, I called them kids, and they allowed that. Some of them had kids. I said, tomorrow, we're not going to have a regular class. We're going to watch a movie. Ow, yeah, bring your popcorn and your handkerchiefs. Huh? To wipe your mouth? No, a little higher up. So we watched this movie. We got about halfway through it. And they said, this is not what we expected. You could pause it, right? And they said, and who is that guy? And I said, that's Henry Fonda. They said, who's Henry Fonda? I said, do you know who Bridget Fonda is? Oh yeah, we know her. That's her grandfather. Her grandfather. We watched the end of the movie, and you know, I had to cry too. I mean, it was very sad. Very, very sad. And where did those people go? They all moved to California, right? To trash yet another non-agricultural setting. So if you can see that happening in a country that has everything, imagine countries that don't have everything. And it happens there too. So growing in tall buildings sounds weird. I mean, it really sounds weird. Because, come and people live in tall buildings. Lehman Brothers, in those days, lived in tall buildings. Tall buildings were not meant for plants. Oh, well, you go to the Ford Foundation, you can see some plants indoors. You go to the Bronx Botanical Garden, you go to the Missouri Botanical Gardens, you go to, you know, Kew Gardens in England. Oh, yeah, you can do it. In fact, you can grow any plant you want indoors. You can grow the most exotic plant in the world, which is this gigantic, disgustingly smelling plant from Borneo. It's the world's largest flower. And when it blooms, like every 16 years or so, there's one in the Bronx Botanical Garden. When it blooms, you don't want to be within a mile of that thing. It smells like rotting flesh. And the reason why is that it attracts flies to it, and that's how it gets pollinated. Well, it bloomed once at the Bronx Botanical Garden. That plant is being grown. All right, so if you can do that, and all the orchids and all the, come on, corn? Are you kidding? Wheat? Barley? Rice? Okay, so we kept working, and here's all the reasons, and this will be on the internet, so don't worry about it. There's no test after this either. But I offer my services to your school to come and give a different take on this if you want me to, because I'm retired. Or I'm retiring, I'm not sure which. So for all of these reasons, it seemed like a good idea. Specifically because it uses less water, much less water. No use of pesticides or herbicides or fertilizers. It does have plant food, but that's, okay, that's a fertilizer, but it's all used by the plants. So you can direct it right to the roots. Unlike outdoors, where you have to spread it out and hope that some of it is taken up by the plants. And that's where the agricultural runoff comes from, because most of it is not taken up by the plants. How wasteful. You know, they used to say, we were so wasteful when we first founded this country. We cut all the trees down and, oh, gee, we made a mistake, so we planted more trees. But we're still throwing fertilizer away like it. Who cares? I can afford it. I'll just pass that savings on to the consumer. You want to pay $2 a carrot? Fine. You'll pay it because it says it's good for you. And I'll get my money back and you'll get yours back and everybody's okay. That's the thinking that's going on now in some places. So, check it out. This is after 11. This was not up in 2010. But it was up in 2011. It's a vertical farm. There were none before this. They invited me, chance to brag. I mean, I don't know whether this is bragging or grandstanding. You forget about that stuff. All I know is that I was invited in 2008 to the Seoul Digital Forum, and there were lots of other people there too, including Sumner Redstone from CBS and Will.i.am. And they had a nice argument on the stage. That was really interesting to see. The sax player from Pink Floyd was there to entertain us. It was cool stuff, cool stuff. The president of Korea shook our hands, right? And Carrie Fowler, who you don't know the name of, but you know his organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, is based in Rome, Italy. And he gave a talk before I went on why every country should have a seed bank. A seed bank, what is that? It's where all the seeds come from in your country that represents the biodiversity of, let's say, in this case, South Korea. He's got one up in Norway that's underneath 100 feet of ice that has all of the world's crops in it, and it's called the Doomsday Vault. I would call it the Salvation Ark, you know, the Ark of plants, basically. So the Noah's Ark of plants, there it is. But if you have a seed bank, how do you know if they're viable? Just move them over to the vertical farm. So Carrie Fowler spoke first in 2008. I spoke second at the symposium on feeding the world. And in 2011, they invited me back. Unprecedented, just like here. I'm so honored. They invited me back to give a talk. And they wanted to surprise me. Boy, did they surprise me. Because next to this building is a 10-story, one half of a New York City square block footprint building called the South Korean Seed Bank. It's in 3 years. It uses grow lights, LED grow lights. Here's the guy that he's ebulliently content over the fact that he had no problems convincing the Korean government this is a good idea worth trying. Okay, there's a lot of good ideas that are not worth trying, but this was a good idea worth trying because the technologies were already there. All you had to do was stitch them together with some engineering to make a one-story greenhouse into a three-story greenhouse. And now we can test out our plants from the Korean seed bank. That's how he sold the idea. But in reality, they're going to feed South Korea this way because it gets cold in the winter. It's a lot of automation. A lot of, these are not cloned plants, but they are of a certain variety of plants. And you can tell they taste good because I just ate something here. And I'm still with us, so. So it was fantastic to see this. And when they took me to lunch first after I gave my talk, before they showed me this place, and they were at some Korean barbecue place out in the countryside. And they kept getting these phone calls from here. Where is he? Where is he? Where is he? Where is who? Where's you? So when I showed up, there were 50 photographers and a big, gigantic electronic, a marquee that said, "Welcome, Dr. Dixon DePommier." It doesn't get better than that, because when you put 106 graduate students behind my name, that's who did this. Okay? It's a miracle. It's a true miracle. But it's not the only one now. So in 2010, there were zero, none. If you went at 2002 or 3 and went to the internet on Google and typed out vertical farm, you got about 10 hits. Try it. See what you get. Just type out vertical farm on Google, and the hits that I'm getting mostly are 30 to 40 million hits a day. On the images, about 15 to 20 million hits a day. So people are pretty interested. So here's a group in Japan that, more Korea. There are seven layers of this. That's as tall as maybe a three-story building. That's a vertical farm. Here's a Japanese version. Guess where their next plant is going? Within 50 miles of Fukushima. Why? Because they can. They can prove to the world that we can manufacture radiation-free food, no matter where, because we're going to import the water and import the nutrients, and the plants will grow. The air is not contaminated. It's the groundwater. So that's what they're doing. They're called New Veggie. It has a website. Highly recommend going to it. It's animation and lots of interesting stuff. All hydroponics, mostly leafy green vegetables, but you can grow whatever you'd like, including this foul-smelling plant from Borneo. If that's what you want to eat, if you're a fly, go for it. Here's what it looks like inside. It looks like a scene out of a James Bond movie. And this is Dr. No's private food supply or something like this. Or he's Singapore's getting onto the bandwagon as well. They want very much to build them, so they've built a three-story vertical farm prototype. The one in Korea is also a prototype. But if you visit Chicago, anybody here from Chicago or visited Chicago recently? The Museum of Science and Industry is a great museum, by the way. Great place to take a lot of kids. They have something called the Futurists. I'm one of those people, honored to be such. And talks about vertical farming in the abstract. You don't need abstract. Just go to the plant. This is a former meatpacking plant in Chicago in the meatpacking district, and it's now a fully functional four-story vertical farm with one of the stories underground. That's where they raise the fish. Here's the new mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, talking with the owner, John Adel, who is a remarkably loquacious person. He's great with words and great with ideas, and he's got a terrific staff that's working for him. And here's the science behind the plant. It's all closed-loop agriculture. It all works because it mirrors ecological process. Oh, so that's ecology 101. Oh, right, got it. Here's how we can relate indoor farming to outdoor plant growth. Here's how you do it. If you make it closed loop, the only thing that goes in are seeds. The only thing that goes out is produce. Everything else stays inside. There's no pollution. And it's a remarkable place. And if you're ever in Chicago, you get free tours. So go take your cameras, and it's fantastic. It's amazing. This was put up over a period of 4 years, but I must also say that it wouldn't have gone up if John Adel hadn't visited the Museum of Science and Industry and seen the exhibit on vertical farming. So that's, again, that reflects back to these 106 students that led me by the nose. Because in the third year, I didn't want to do that project. I wanted to work on something else. Because, you know, 3 years is enough, right? Not enough. And the class was now 20 people. And I said, oh, all right. So then after that, it became easier to do it. And this is the way it looks on your plate. Come on. But, as my wife would say, who shall remain unnamed in this video, this is not a proof of concept. This is the concept. In Linköping, Sweden, last year, a group called Plantagon, it's a takeoff on the name Plant, not a takeoff, that's the name Plant, and the Onondagan Indians of New York State that have made so much money by taking advantage of our penchant for wanting to spend our income on silly things like roulette. They've taken all that money and invested it in public works projects that are also guaranteed to make money for the Onondagan Indians, but now they're feeding people. This is a 17-story vertical farm under construction as we speak in a little town called Linköping. If you don't know where it is, there's another town called Malmö, right, with an umlaut over the O. It's supposed to be the most ecologically advanced city in the world. It uses all kinds of interesting things to generate electricity, to keep carbon footprints to the minimum, to keep pollution to the minimum, to recycle wastewater into drinking water. And Linköping wants to outdo them. And they're going to start by producing food for their own city. See, because Malmö has to import everything. And they imagine it to look something like this. That is, I cried. Literally cried when I saw this. It doesn't, Sam, you heard this idea when it first started. It has no right to have advanced this fast to this level. And these people are ignoring all of the naysayers, including The Guardian, which will be forced to write another article saying, you know what, we were wrong, okay, we were wrong, big deal. Next subject. That's not quite the way to do that. I drove back through Jackson, Wyoming, and here's, if you ever get out to Jackson, Wyoming on your vacations, just go there, because next year this will be a 3-story vertical farm to allow migrant workers to stop migrating. Why would you have to go somewhere else when you can stay here and work? So it raises the question, who's going to be next? Well, Will Allen, I don't know if you've heard of his group now. They're in Milwaukee. He's a former professional basketball player that played in Belgium. And if you watch the Olympics, you see how close other countries are coming to the United States with regards to ability to play that game. So Will took his savings, came back to Milwaukee, said, I want to do some good for the community, started an indoor gardening group, teaching people how to compost and make their own soil and stuff like this. But he outgrew his space in about 2 years. Now he wants this to replace it. That's the coolest stuff. This architecture firm also designed the Aldo Leopold Center in Wisconsin and the Crane Recovery Center in Wisconsin. Now both, you may not know about either one of those, but if you looked them up on the internet, you'd see Aldo Leopold was one of the first persons to outline how to manage wildlife. And he wrote a wonderful book that you'll all enjoy reading called Sand County Almanac, which I think is one of the most beautifully written nature books ever. You can read it in one night. You may even want your students to read it, who knows. Anyway, this architecture firm is doing this pro bono. It doesn't get much better than that. A group in Holland is building a 3-story vertical farm underground because you don't need sunlight. In fact, they claim that sunlight is inhibitory to the photosynthetic process and that by just exposing them to two wavelengths in the 400 and 700 nanometer range, you can maximize plant growth and minimize inhibition. So they get a doubling of the growth rate. Cool stuff. If you want to see proof of it, go to a YouTube video called Volks Garden, V-O-L-K-S Garden. You may even want to buy one for your school. It's an awesome wheel of life that you plant on the inside with a grow light in the center, and this thing rotates slowly around, picking up nutrients as it goes through the trough at the bottom. And it's amazing. Disorienting the plants from gravity forces them to also grow about twice as fast as they would, because they want to rush to produce their reproductive structures because they think they're under stress, and they are. So the best way to get plants to grow fast is to stress them just enough. The best way to get students to perform is to test them. Same concept. The old Navy Pier in Chicago is old, and it's a Navy Pier. So they want to change their image because Chicago is the architectural capital of the world. Look what they have planned for a vertical farm iteration right next to one of the most amazing buildings that's just been produced. So they're way ahead of the curve. Of course I'm going to pander. Of course I've written a book on this subject. And in fact, I can tell you that when I wrote the book and it came out as a hardcover, there were no vertical farms, none. A year later, the softcover came out. There were three. So the three vertical farms that I've talked about in Korea, Japan, and Holland are talked about in this softcover book. So don't buy the hardcover book. But I know that Jay has had experience with this. He bought some of these for some of you, I think. And all of you have this book already. I'm flattered. And I'm, thank you. you also noticed some mistakes in the printing, and some of you got copies that didn't quite work out. We passed that word back to the publisher. It's their fault, not mine. So I think it's going to get even more exciting in the near future, because this idea is now out there. It's being looked, it's not just being looked at, it's being done. All right? So we're at the stage now where we're beyond the Wright brothers. We're now thinking about transporting mail with the first airplanes and dropping bombs, of course, out of the sides, which is what they used them for to begin with. So thank you. Ooh.